Hare Krishna, welcome to Chasing Reality with me, Ryan, known by some as Ramananda Das. Today's guest, we have Brenda Dunn. I met Brenda in January 2019 at the Consciousness in Science Conference, the first one, hopefully of many to come, organized by the Bhaktivedanta Institute for Higher Studies in Gainesville, Florida. So we managed to have a little discussion after one of her talks. I'm very happy that today she's agreed to come on and speak to some more to me, because she's got a fascinating research history of over 30 years working at the Princeton Engineering Anomalous Research Institute, so PEAR, based at Princeton University. It was running from 1979 until 2007, headed by Professor Robert Jan. Brenda was the laboratory manager there, so she knows everything that happened, and it was all about the effects of consciousness on matter. So a topic that titillates me no end, so I'm looking forward to discussing that. She's authored and co-authored over 100 publications, a 2009 book, Margins of Reality, with Robert Jan. Without further ado, let's get cracking. Thank you very much, Brenda, for joining me today on this Chasing Reality podcast. But I have a question for you. What were you doing for 30 years in the Princeton University basement? I think you're in the basement.
Well, you know, we, in 1979, Professor Robert John, my dear friend and colleague, who passed away almost 2 years ago now, but at the time he was dean of the Princeton School of Engineering and Applied Science. And through the interest of an undergraduate, he agreed to supervise an independent project that involved constructing a random number generator and attempting to see whether people could influence the output just by thinking about it. This was a topic that he had very little interest in, if any. He was really an aerospace engineer, and his primary area of research was advanced aerospace propulsion systems. But he felt that from a pedagogical perspective, it seemed like a reasonable project to encourage. So he agreed to supervise it, and the student went ahead with building a little breadboard random event generator and carrying on some experiments and coming up with some rather striking results. Okay. He became very intrigued, went on to increase his interest in the topic, which was really from an engineering point of view. And that was really what guided the program all those years. We were not studying psychic phenomena. We were not studying people. We were looking at the potential vulnerability of engineering systems and processes to the anomalous influence of human consciousness. So, to make a very long and involved and really quite fascinating story short, he eventually was able to obtain permission from his university to set up this program. It was very reluctant permission. But because of their adherence to the tenets of academic freedom, they agreed, thinking, well, he'd find out there was nothing there and get it out of his system and get on with his real work. In the meantime, I had been living in the Chicago area and had carried out some exploratory studies in remote viewing, attempting to replicate some of the work that had been done at SRI by Harold Puthoff and Russell Targ. And like this student of Bob's, I was able to get some rather striking results and was giving a talk about that at a professional society meeting where Bob was attending, looking around and trying to identify someone that he could hire to help with the day-to-day management of his program. Yeah. And we met during a coffee break with a what I have in retrospect regarded as one of the great cosmic openings. I approached him and said, I understand you've been looking for me. And he said, you might say that.
Wow.
But in any event, we hit it off immediately. He told me he was interested in setting this program up. Would I have any interest in working with him? I very enthusiastically said yes. And over the next year, we went on a massive undertaking to get the program approved, to get me appointed, and to obtain funding for the program. And in June of 1979, we started the program. It was located in a little, what had been a storage area in the basement of the engineering school next to the machine shop, which nobody was using. And we just commandeered it, expanded it by a bit, and created a magical kingdom down there that we eventually came to call the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research, or PAIR, Laboratory. The program had really three main parts. One of them was, looking at various types of random physical systems and processes to see if people could affect it just by their intentions. The second part was trying to develop analytical quantitative methods for assessing the amount of information that was acquired in the remote perception or remote viewing experiments. And the third part was basically just wondering what in the world was going on here, because clearly we were looking at something that was inexplicable. And that was what we did. We had a number of random physical devices. The main one was a microelectronic random event generator, or REG as we called it. But we also had a very large macroscopic mechanical device we called a random mechanical cascade. It was a huge pinball machine that sat on one wall of the laboratory. It was about 10 feet tall and I think 8 feet wide, and it dropped some 3,000 little marbles down through a maze of pins into a series of collecting bins, which resulted in a distribution that looked very Gaussian, a bell-shaped curve, basically. And there were a couple of other experiments, a fountain, we had a pendulum, we had a drum that was driven by a random event generator, a drumstick. But the main data, the largest database really, was on the microscopic REG. And in those experiments, we just had volunteers who were all anomalous, but they were also anonymous. And they were volunteers. You know, we didn't pay them. We did not study people, because our university had instructed us that we could not do any psychological studies, that we had to stick to the engineering issues. Okay. They had a number of other constraints, such as telling us that we needed to make sure that our participants did not suffer from delusions of metaphysical capabilities as a result of participating in these experiments, which was rather humorous. It actually turned out to be a favor, because when people came in, if they were a little bit nervous or intimidated, I would inform them that they should not leave here thinking they were God unless they thought they were God when they arrived. And that would make them laugh. And the laughter would break the tension and they would relax. And I think that actually helped. But it was a rather bizarre instruction. But basically, the protocol we followed looked at intention as the primary variable. And we followed what we called a tripolar protocol, that is a three-part, three different directions of intention. Now, the random event generator produced a sequence of binary bits, ones and zeros, which were sampled in trials of 200. And by chance, you would expect about 100 ones and 100 zeros, although, of course, it wouldn't always be exactly 100. Yeah. But over many large databases and many repetitions, you'd expect it to regress to that theoretical mean. So people sat in front of the device, and they would then have a pre-recorded intention that was recorded in a logbook and on the computer file, where they would attempt to either get more high numbers, that is, if you will, more ones, or more low numbers, say more zeros, or to just do a baseline, that is, just sit there and let the machine run on its own. And then we would look for correlations between the intention and the actual machine output. All of the experiments required very large databases of at least minimum was 1,000 trials of 200 each, per intention, although we preferred databases of about 10,000 or more. And we wanted people to come back and return and do more series again and again and create as large a database as we could convince them to do. So it was very important to try to make this fun, to treat this as a game, and rather than telling people, we were not studying the people. We were studying the machines, and we valued our participants' input, which was very helpful. Most of them, especially the ones who were most successful, would tell us that, you know, it's more than just my intention. I have to have a feeling of connection with the device, some kind of a resonance. I have to feel like the machine and I are one. The example sometimes they would say would be like playing a musical instrument or driving a car, where the machine becomes an extension of oneself. This turned out to be a very important variable. And we were able to carry out some experiments where we would take little miniature random event generators out into the field and let them run in environments that were conducive to group resonance. You know, it might be a concert, it might be a spiritual meeting or a religious service or some situation where people would somehow be sharing an emotional experience. And the random event generator was running in the background. Nobody really knew it was there. But the experimenter would mark it at times that seemed to be particularly intense emotionally. And we discovered that indeed the output showed the correlation with those periods of time by departing from mean chance during that time. So anyway, there were a lot of variables. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into here, but we looked at a lot of things: distance, how far away you had to be from the machine, whether you had to be doing it at the same time the machine was running. We tried different feedbacks. We looked at, I don't know, I could go on and on, but the bottom line is that over many millions of trials, we found a statistically significant correlation between human intention and the REG output. There was no question that something real was going on. And similar results were found with the other experiments. Now, with the remote perception or remote viewing experiments, over the years, we conducted, some 600 and some odd trials, not to particularly demonstrate that the system worked, but to acquire data that we could then look at and try to develop analytical algorithms that would allow us to measure how much information was being acquired. And again, long story short, over this long era, the correlation between the information that was acquired and the actual targets was very strong and well beyond chance. So that's what I was doing for 28 years at PAIR, and spending many hours with Bob John trying to figure out what in the world was going on. It was very clear to both of us very early on that we were looking at something that was far more profound than whether people could affect machines. We were looking at some fundamental process of human consciousness and how it interacted with the physical world. And indeed, the subtitle of our first book, Margins of Reality, was The Role of Consciousness in the Physical World. And we came up with a number of different, theoretical models that we could explore or, tentatively apply. And we had a great time. The lab was a fun place. It was not your typical university laboratory. It was carpeted and it had paneled walls. It had lots of stuffed animals, cartoons on the walls. And it was just a very friendly place with a friendly staff that came from different disciplines. We had physicists, engineers, psychologists. Usually there were about five people working there at any given time. Sometimes we had students who had come by to do an internship. And we were in a very small space, so we had to work together well. And we did. And that interdisciplinary collaboration was imperative. It was just really vital to the results that we got. All right, so there's a short answer, Ryan. I hope that helped.
That's very helpful. Actually, the topic of interdisciplinary study is something I'd like to touch on maybe another time. That's something of great interest to me. Let me see if I've captured what you've said so far.
Sure.
Just to repeat it back for our viewers, because some of the terms they might not be familiar with. So it sounds like in 1979, you had, how did you put it? You met Robert John at a convention, and yeah. it was like it was meant to be. There was, one of those moments, and came out of that was 28 years of incredible research in a kind of converted basement at Princeton University, which I didn't realize. You said that Robert was obviously was in the engineering department, so it was very strict as to what kind of research you were doing. It had nothing to do with psychology, nor could it have. It was more to do with the serious the implications if people or conscious people somehow affect machinery that we're always using in the world in the technological era, that could be dangerous. We need to understand if that's happening or not. So that was the kind of main purpose.
It would have great engineering implications. That was really what drove the program originally.
Okay, so there could be something that spawns out of it. There could be some great products or ideas that come out of this. And then you said that there were three main things that you were doing, or three main aspects you were looking at. First of all, it was the using a random event generator. So I understand that to mean like a mechanical version of flipping a coin.
Right.
So you were just, or sorry, like a digital version with the zeros and ones. And so then you would see, and you also had a mechanical version in terms of these cascading balls. And so normally you would expect if you flip a coin, approximately 50-50 after X number of repeats. And so you get a kind of normal distribution curve. And your aim was to see, can people they affect the distribution? Of the distribution curve, can they affect the probability or the whether something's gonna be a one or a zero?
Right.
And so yes, so you were doing that, but you said also about remote viewing. I want to get onto that because you haven't spoken so much about that yet. But my understanding is that's to do with being able to see something remotely, which your senses have no access to.
Correct.
It's actually quite incredible. I think people who haven't heard of this, they wouldn't believe it. I've participated in a trial, a particular trial of this, and I can vouch for the power of the technique, at least the technique that I tried. You won't believe it until you try it.
Right. No, you won't.
I mean, it just sounds crazy.
Especially since you can describe a scene that hasn't been identified yet, that can be thousands of miles away. I mean, this effect is independent of distance or of time, which makes it even crazier.
Cool, that's wild. I mean, that's going to get a lot of people scratching their heads, which is good. Yeah. We should scratch our heads more often. So we've got this, these random event generators. Can we affect them? We've got remote viewing. So can we see with, you know, in irrespective of space and time and with, without having access to our senses, can we see particular things that are happening? And you said, I think you said the third thing was trying to piece it all together, maybe in terms of, you know, philosophy, psychology, to try and understand what's going on here. And then, you know, books and articles and various things came out of that. Did I miss anything, or correct me if I...
Yeah, that was great. And you used a lot fewer words than I did. Thank you.
No, I want to go into more of the your details, because I am so fascinated by this subject. As a biologist, I mean, I'm not in the lab anymore, but I was always thinking this. And any scientist listening to this, if you're a crystallographer, you'll totally get this. But even in biology, which is potentially less fickle than crystallography, you do a polymerase chain reaction, a PCR. And what it means is you add DNA, a template of DNA, to a little solution, and you add certain enzyme that will allow you to, under certain changing temperatures, to amplify your DNA product, so that you start with a little bit and you end up with a lot. That's basically how forensics works, because you have a little bit of DNA and you need loads of it to do analysis. But there's one incredible thing that I always noticed. All biologists, molecular biologists, will tell you this. One day you'll use exactly the same chemicals, and the next day and it will work, and then the next day it won't work. Nothing will happen. Mm-hmm. You won't get your amplification of DNA. And there were jokes. There were many jokes. For example, it's almost as if my nan's blood pressure in Australia is affecting this PCR reaction in Glasgow. I mean, it was just that silly.
Was it though?
Yeah, so I do wonder, in science, we're trying to, but the way we write is to try, we try and be very objective about it. Are we? That's a question I have for you. Yeah, so are we as objective as we think we are? Have you looked into any of those aspects at all in terms of research? Obviously, yours was more into the applied field. I'm wondering, in research, is it possible that actually we're affecting the results? Like, some people can crystallize proteins, and other people just, they can't do it for the life of them.
Well, we talked about this a lot. We really explored it, you know, left, right, upside down, and backward. And there's no question that there's something going on here, and that it has to do with the subjective dimension, working together with the objective. Scientists like to think they're being objective and they're taking themselves out of the picture, but you can't take yourself out of the picture. Science is a process of consciousness. Our minds decide what we're going to study, how we're going to set up our experiments, what analyses we're going to use, how we're going to interpret it, and more importantly, what we want to find. Mm-hmm. And anytime, it would seem from our research that anytime you have a random component involved, and it's very hard to think of something that doesn't, there is an opportunity for some kind of influence to penetrate through that barrier between the subjective and objective. I'm very fond of the a line from the one of the songs of Leonard Cohen. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he was a Canadian poet and songwriter who passed away recently. But one of his songs had the line, "There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." Mm-hmm. Which to me is just so profound. But you know, the business of biology is also fascinating. The results we got could not possibly be explained by any known physical model. You just cannot talk about something that's independent of distance and time without any fall off of effect. It defies everything we know about psychology, because psychology knows, of course, that all of our information is based on our senses. But there is one place, one field that has some real possibilities, and that's the field of biology. Where else can you find a system where a very tiny effect repeated over many, many repetitions involving some random process could produce a shift in the mean of an output distribution. It sounded, you know, to us like we were talking about evolution. Mm-hmm. And the more we thought about it, the more we found indicators that certain, I won't say physiological, biological processes seem to be involved here. I think we had talked when we first met about this experiment that had been done with these baby chickens.
Oh, I love this one.
Where there was this robot that was being driven by a random process. These newly hatched chicks were exposed to the robot and imprinted on it and thought it was their mother. And they would be following it around. And then the chicks would be isolated in a cage at one end of this field. And the robot would be wandering around out there. And the chicks would become agitated. They wanted to be with their mother. And the robot turned out to spend significantly more time in the area near the chicks' cage than it should. Now, those chicks are not using any higher cognitive abilities, and they are not familiar with the laws of physics. They just wanted their mother. And they had a strong emotional need to be with their mother. And this process of bonding, of course, is a biological process. The process by which two or more individuals come together in a shared experience, such as a theatrical performance or meditation session. Something is going on here that has to do with the some evolutionary process, maybe akin to, you know, Teilhard de Chardin's view of a collective consciousness, but the universe becoming conscious of itself. And we individuals, like cells in a larger organism, can come together and enable that larger organism to function more efficiently. Anyway, we actually published a book, our ICRL Press published a book a couple of years back called Being and Biology, Is Consciousness the Life Force? And it's an anthology, a collection of some, I think it was 16 or 17 essays by people who were addressing that question from different disciplinary perspectives. And I was the editor of the book, and it was really fascinating to see all the different points of view that one could bring to bear on this topic. And there again, just referring back to this interdisciplinarity, if science is an act of consciousness, mm-hmm. you cannot understand consciousness from within any given science.
Right.
The only way I think you can understand it or begin to is by triangulating from different perspectives, looking at it from different points of view and see where the overlaps are. And indeed, there are overlaps. But the more I've looked at that, the more persuaded I am that we're looking at some fundamental Elan Vital that's going on here. We're not looking at whether humans can affect machines. It's much bigger than that. And after a while, you start writing consciousness with a capital C. but in any event, I'm going off topic and I apologize, but...
No, please, it's fascinating. You've got so many years of experience with this. Let your thoughts drift where they may, because they're infused with experience and wisdom. I really appreciate them. Yeah.
Well, you should be. You may be sorry for that, because my thoughts do tend to wander here and there. but I'm happy to. No, this was a fascinating experience these years. It was a challenge because, of course, the topic was not welcomed either within the university or within the academic world in general. Scientific and establishment did not want to acknowledge it, still doesn't. There were a lot of battles, we faced a lot of resistance. And, but at the same time, we kind of had fun because both Bob and I were, you know, Franz Kafka once described himself as a professional disturber of sleep. I like to think of myself as a disturber of sleep. Not so much from a vindictive point of view, but just a playful point of view. People who get stuck tend to get stuck in their worldview, and they can't get beyond it. And when you are able to push a belief system past its established boundaries, sometimes, certainly not all the time, people think again and go, oh, I never thought of that. And one of the projects that Bob and I did, in fact, it's another one of our books called Quirks of the Quantum Mind. We took a look at the principles of quantum mechanics. In the physics world, quantum mechanics is regarded as an explanation for the behavior of subatomic phenomena. But like any model or representation, quantum mechanics is an activity, a model is a product of consciousness. It is not a description of the world. It is a description of our subjective experience of the world.
Yes.
So in many respects, any of these models can tell us as much about how we represent our experience as it does about what it is we think we're experiencing. And we had a lot of fun with that too. We went down the whole list of all of the quantum mechanical principles and were able to demonstrate that all of them had psychological correlations. In fact, one of my favorite stories is Bob had invited me to sit in on a graduate level course in quantum mechanics that he was teaching. Mm-hmm. And I had never taken a physics class in my life.
Same.
Thank you. And I said, well, I'm not going to be able to follow all that math. He says, don't worry about the math. Just try to get the general gist of it. So I did. And after a few classes, one of the students said to me, aren't you a psychologist? And I said, yes. And he said, well, why are you taking a class in quantum mechanics? And I said, quantum mechanics? I thought this was the psychology of subatomic particles. And indeed, that's what it is. It is, and you can really have some fun with it. Furthermore, when we finished the general paper, we wrote an appendix in which we had gone back and looked at all of the philosophical writings of just about all of the patriarchs of modern physics. Einstein, Bohr, Heisenberg, Pauli, Schrödinger, etc. And lo and behold, all of them recognized that what was going on had to do with consciousness. Mm. When they were talking about the role or the act of observation, they were talking about the act of consciousness.
Yes.
When the human consciousness makes an observation, it acquires information, but it also generates information. And they were all right there. And of course, the wonderful thing about that was that in those days, a century or so ago, those guys had very broad educations. And almost all of them were interested in some of the more esoteric philosophies. Niels Bohr was very much interested in Taoism and biology.
Yeah.
Schrödinger was into Indian philosophy, the Upanishads and the Vedas and so forth. Heisenberg was fond of quoting many of the Greek philosophers and so forth and so on. And they had many discussions in which they talked about all of these perspectives. There was one lovely anecdote in one of Heisenberg's books in which he described a discussion that along these lines, in which Paul Dirac, who was a very ardent atheist, was protesting any effort to bring God into this picture, or in which Wolfgang Pauli apparently said or announced, there is no God, and Dirac is his prophet. which of course broke everybody up and, you know, relaxed the tension in the room.
Yeah.
But the important thing was that we discovered that all of them recognized, there was not a single one, except maybe Dirac, who would have objected to what we were saying about quantum mechanics being a psychological or a consciousness process. So anyway, that was one of the efforts that we did. And we also, you know, came up with a number of other, I don't even want to call them theories, but models, testable models, but concepts around which we could possibly try to fit these anomalous phenomena. For example, you can imagine, if you will, a large square, like a window, they're divided into four sections.
Yep.
And up here, you've got the mental, and up here, you've got the physical. And here, you've got the conscious, the awake physical, mental world. And down here, you've got the subconscious or unconscious world. And here you've got the physical, the classical physical world, and then down here you've got the quantum physical world. Except as you go down further and further, the distinction between the unconscious and the subatomic blurs, and suddenly there's no more distinction.
Right.
So information is constantly being exchanged at that level because there's no distinction. And it can trickle back up into the observable domains in ways that would appear to be anomalous. I'm not going to take your time by describing all of our models, but we did have a lot of fun. We continued the program for, as you pointed out, 28 years. In 2007, we felt it was time to go. We had done it. It was just doing more of the same. People were saying, oh, can you replicate it? You can't go back and try to, you know, redo something. And you can't do this kind of work to prove something to other people. You do it because you are interested and you're trying to learn something. Also, Bob had reached the age where he was retiring from the university. And we would have had to have somebody else with some established credentials or tenure take over the program. There was nobody who could do that. Mm-hmm. So a few years before that, in anticipating this shift, we established a small not-for-profit operation that we called International Consciousness Research Laboratories, or ICRL. And when we closed the lab, we kind of moved our base of operations to ICRL, which is not at the university. It was not beholden to any constraints that the university placed on us. And ICRL continues to this day. It does, you know, a lot of things. We're not doing any more active research ourselves, but we are encouraging and advising other people who are doing, you know, research explorations. We have a book publishing imprint called the ICRL Press, and we just finished publishing our 17th book, which, by the way, it's called Connected, The Emergence of a Global Consciousness, I believe. It's by Roger Nelson, who was a member of the PAIR staff for many years. And if prompted by some of these experiments that I mentioned that we called field reg, where you took the REG into the field and looked to see if there was a field effect by many
people. My friend's got one of them. My colleague's got one of them, and we've played around with it, the field reg. What an incredible device to see. It's like sensing and recording the synergy of, or maybe not just synergy, but the emotional content. I don't know if that's the right word.
Syntropy, I think, is
syntropy,
because that's the counter force to entropy, when things come together as opposed when things break apart. That's another one of the books we published. But anyway, Roger has set up a program he called the Global Consciousness Network. in which he had random event generators placed in different places all over the planet.
Oh, yes, yes.
And they would just be running all the time and feeding their random output into a common server. But at times when there were global events of intense emotional import, it turned out that these devices would become less random. They would become more, the variance would be reduced, okay? They seem to be coming into sync with each other. And he's done several hundred of these events. And I think the most famous one is the traces he got at the time of the 9/11 attacks of the World Towers. Although I am particularly impressed by the events, by the traces he got at the moment that Bob John passed on, which for reasons, you know, unknown, at precisely that moment, this device shot up to something close to 3 standard deviations from the mean. I thought that was Bob's way of saying arrivederci. Excuse me. But anyway, our most recent book describes, or it's Roger's book, of course, we just published it, but it describes this program. And it's really quite fascinating. If anybody in your listening audience is interested, they can look at a catalog of our press books on the ICRL website, which is www.icrl.org. And if you go to that and click on ICRL Press, there's a list of all of our books with a little description. So thank you for allowing me that plug.
No, people will benefit greatly if they read some of this material, I'm sure.
Yeah, there are 2 books that actually go into some detail about the PAIR laboratory, our research, our results. The first one, Margins of Reality, the Role of Consciousness in the Physical World, was written when the program was about 8 years old. And then we did a sequel when we closed the program called Consciousness and the Source of Reality, the PAIR Odyssey. And then the third one was The Quirks of the Quantum Mind, which described this quantum mechanical model. But there are quite a few other books that, you know, for not just by us, but by other people, that I think they all tend to address some aspect of the relationships among mind or consciousness, spirituality, and science. You know, I was fond of saying there's not much difference between science and spirituality. In one case, it's you're looking for the nature of reality, and in the other, you're looking for the reality of nature. But basically, it's the same search coming from 2 directions. And Bob and I believed that, or hoped, I should say, that where our work would lead would be to what we refer to as a science of the subjective, an expansion of the prevailing scientific paradigm to accommodate consciousness as a proactive agent in reality, and to be willing to expand, to look at the complementarity between subjectivity and objectivity. We're not looking to throw science out. We're looking to expand it and to allow it to incorporate those dimensions that up until now it's excluded. I believe that if we don't accommodate it and we can't find a role for consciousness, science is going to be at a dead end. It really can't go any further. It just can keep smashing particles apart and finding what you're predicting is going to happen. And if you're looking for a Higgs boson, you'll probably find one sooner or later. And I think it was Heisenberg who once said something to the effect of, if an observation has an energy that is greater than the rest mass of the particle involved, you can be pretty sure you've invented it. And I think that's what's going on. I think a lot of contemporary science is just extrapolating from what they think they already know, But yeah. I'm not sure how much of it is real knowledge. Anyway, I don't want to sit here and bash science. I'm really quite fond of it as a process. I think the scientific method is beautiful. It's a brilliant creation of consciousness. Mm-hmm. But it is not science as it is seen today as a body of knowledge. Is not science as I perceive it. Science is a process, not a thing. So, you told me to let my mind wander. I'm
glad I did that. That's the best thing I could have done, because I'm learning a lot. I'm sure many people on this who listen to this will as well. It's fantastic. I do have two questions before I let you go. I really want to answer these ones. One of them is, what would you say to, you know, critics that the consciousness isn't something that exists? It emerges from, must emerge from brain activity, and it's not something that can do all these, it hasn't got these properties that you're describing, and the experiments you did, they must be flawed. Obviously, you can't convince everyone, it's just the way the world is. But I'm just interested in what you would say briefly to those people. And lastly, just after that, what would you say to encourage young people who may be confused and as to the importance of this? They don't just have to be scientists, but, you know, anyone who's coming up.
Those are great questions. I think that the empirical evidence of our studies and of so many other people's, it's not just us, are making it very clear that consciousness is not an epiphenomenon of the physical brain. The physical brain is important to it, but it is not the origin. I like to think that the physical brain acts sort of like a tuner, if you will, like a TV set. You know, all of these frequencies and amplitudes are floating all over the place all the time, but you have to have an instrument to tune it in, and you can then dial the channel you want. And I think that's what our brains do. In my view of consciousness, and I think Bob would have agreed with me, is that it is, let's go back to consciousness with a capital C, as the organizing principle of the universe. Mm. The yang to the yin of the potentiality of the cosmos. There is all this great potentiality of possibility, and then there is an organizing principle that uses that to create. And that is what consciousness does, whether it's with a big C or a little C. Yeah. We also create our own reality on the level of our own experiences out of what William James referred to as this aboriginal sensible muchness. Isn't that a wonderful phrase? Mm-hmm. Aboriginal sensible muchness. So that is what I think consciousness is. I do not think you're going to ever find consciousness in the brain because it's not there. Right. I mean, people want to spend money and time looking for it in there. They're welcome to, but I think that's a dead end, because I think consciousness isn't a thing. And it isn't even a process in the usual physical sense. It's a principle. And this is how we have to look at it. As I mentioned before, like syntropy and entropy, you have two principles that are complementary. And consciousness and the aboriginal sensible muchness are also complementary, much as the yin and the yang are in Chinese, or Shiva and Shakti in the Indian, or, you know, many traditions have this kind of complementary creative principle. Okay, next question. What would I tell young people? I used to tell people who would say, how do I get involved in this field? And I'll tell them that they have to have three things. They need a well-calibrated random event generator. They need a thick skin, and they need a sense of humor. And you need imagination. I would tell people, don't be intimidated by the authorities. Don't let other people tell you what to think. Go with what your heart calls you to. and trust it, because your heart has a wisdom that I think is far deeper and more profound than the wisdom of your cognitive brain. You know, be courageous. Go where, you know, you feel drawn, and believe in what you are drawn to, and don't let anyone talk you out of it. That's my advice. You know, I really wish our educational system from infancy on isn't directed at discouraging imagination. I wish we could get rid of the things that people say, like, oh, it's only your imagination. Oh, it was just a dream. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not real. No, wrong. We need to teach our children to play. We don't have to teach them. Children know how to play. We have to allow them to play. And we need to encourage them to continue to play, you know, even when you get to be my advanced age. Deep inside, I'm still a kid, and I don't hope I never change.
Thank you. So, that's really, really nice.
Anyway, that would be my advice to young people.
Thank you, Brenda. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that people are, this is what I get from that as a kind of overall feeling, is that people are far more incredible than maybe they even realize they are. They have the capacity to do so much. And they should be, they allow yourself a little bit to be guided by your heart, which contains wisdom beyond what we really understand. But actually, it sounds like you've been guided, and you've kept this playful attitude and still feel as young as ever.
I really feel I have. And I really feel that the worst words in the English language are, what will people think? Don't worry about what people will think. Be yourself, and follow your dreams. You know, you may be wrong, but it's going to be much more satisfying.
Yeah,
and you'll have more fun.
Thank you, Brenda. It's been really amazing talking to you today. Let's see, maybe in the future, I've got what I want to do in the future. I haven't shared this actually on my podcast yet, but I want to matchmake. I want to be a facilitator and get people talking in twos, such that we can get this syntropy.
Maybe mm-hmm.
I want ideas to flow and cross pollination between different fields to happen. And as I'm talking to people, I'm getting ideas about different researchers and thinkers who I could put together and do. Oh wow, it would be incredible. Just as a little
you must be psychic.
Oh really?
So if you want to continue with that and follow up on that in one of your future meetings, I'd be delighted to work with you on it.
Perfect. Okay, great. Because this is such a nice medium, one-on-one, one with two. I really feel like there's so much that comes out of that, and you can really get into the details, and it's been a pleasure today, so thank you.
Yeah, well, this has been fun, and now I know how to use Zoom. I have now acquired a new skill.
Yes.
Well, Ryan, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, and I look forward to doing it again.
Thank you very much, Brenda, and all the best. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for joining me today on Chasing Reality podcast. This talk that I had with Brenda Dunn was incredible. I actually feel so inspired. I feel really alive right now. She's not just a scientist. You can tell that she's really trying to understand the nature of reality. And I won't go into a big summary now of everything that she said, but I think the key message is that consciousness has to be taken seriously as something that's fundamental to reality. It's not just something that comes out of the brain that we're going to be able to pop a label on and put it in a test tube. What it really means is that we are potentially far more incredible and vulnerable than we think. For example, if you can affect a machine with your consciousness, what are you doing to other people? What am I doing when I'm thinking negatively about someone versus what am I doing when I'm thinking positively? So this raises questions. If consciousness can affect people and things remotely, maybe if someone's in my prayers, or if there are many people who hate a certain person, will that affect their health? These are all questions that are prime for research, and hopefully at some point soon in the future we're going to get this really coming together so that science starts to embrace consciousness rather than be afraid of it, that it's going to let religion in the back door. Because the scientific process is amazing, as Brenda said, but we need to expand the ontology. So thank you very much, and have a lovely day wherever you are. Hare Krishna, and goodbye.